So welcome everyone to Dharma Day, when we celebrate the teachings of the Buddha, particularly celebrating the teachings of the Buddha as they've come down to us through the generations, through all the teachers, and particularly through our own teacher, the Venerable Sangharakshita, who's on the shrine. The ribbons on the shrine represent that flow of the teachings coming down from the generations, coming down from the Buddha, coming down through all the scriptures, coming down through the teachers. So the flow of the teachings have been there down through the generations, and they come to us. And the whole purpose of us being here today, and the whole purpose of us taking up Buddhism, as it were, is to first of all receive the teachings, then to practice them, and then to pass them on. That's the whole. We're part of that flow of the Dharma coming down the generations. If you're relatively new, you might not feel like that, but actually, even from the very beginning, even if you've just learned how to do the first stage of the mindfulness of breathing, that's something that you can give to somebody else. Of course, only if they want it. You shouldn't give it to people if they don't want it. Yeah. So my talk today is called Every Day is Dharma Day. And you can see why every day is Dharma Day, because if we're practicing and learning and receiving and so on, that's not something that happens once a year. It's not something that happens twice a year or once a month. It's something that's happening every day. And specifically, this talk is about the six recollections, which are the six anusatis. So I'll explain a bit about that. I came across this teaching when I was reading Ratnaguna's book that was published recently called Great Faith, Great Wisdom. And he just happens to quote a little bit from the text in his book. And it caught my attention, and it led me to want to explore it further. And the bit, actually I've got it written there, but I think it would be more impressive if I pick up the Anguttara Nikaya, where it comes from. This sutta appears in three places in the Anguttara Nikaya. The Anguttara Nikaya is a text which is, it's the numbers. So it's the lists of the three of this, the four of this, the five of this, and so on. And this is the section of the elevens. So you might wonder why the six recollections come from the section of the elevens. I'll tell you shortly. But here's the bit that caught my attention. It says, and the sutta is addressed to a man called Mahanama. So Mahanama was a lay follower of the Buddha. He wasn't a monk. And the Buddha says to him, Mahanama, you should develop this recollection while walking, standing, sitting, and lying down. You should develop it while engaged in work and while living at home in a house full of children. So, basically the Buddha is saying to Mahanama, it's not a meditation practice where you sit down and do it for half an hour or an hour. This is something that you do all the time. Now this sutta starts off with a different teaching. It starts off with a teaching of the five spiritual faculties. Some of you may be familiar with the five spiritual faculties, which are meditation, wisdom, faith and energy, and mindfulness. And it's said with the five spiritual faculties that the central practice is mindfulness. And of course the word for mindfulness there is sati, mindfulness. It's said that with the other four spiritual faculties, you could take them too far, you could overemphasize them, but you can't do too much of sati. You can't be too mindful, you can't be too aware. You can take awareness as far as you want. So that's the beginning of the sutta. The Buddha talks to Mahanama about the five spiritual faculties. And then he enlarges on this sati aspect. So the sutta then becomes basically about these six different reflections or six different recollections which the Buddha is recommending and then which he is saying and seems to think is possible to bear in mind whatever you're doing, whatever the circumstances. So probably many of us don't have time to do a lot of meditation or puja or even don't have time to put aside for quiet reflection and so on. But the Buddha is saying, well, this you can do while you're going about your life. So this might be a practice for those of us who are time poor, as it were. And the basic practice is to bring to mind six different things, one at a time, and just let your mind dwell on them. They're called the six anusati. So sati, as I said, means mindfulness or awareness, and anusati means constant mindfulness, constant awareness. And the six anusatis, the six recollections are, one, the Buddha, recollecting the Buddha, two, recollecting the Dharma, three, recollecting the Sangha, four, recollecting your own generosity, five, recollecting your own virtues or integrity, and six, recollecting the gods. Now that last one is going to need a bit more explanation, which will come later. So what I'm going to do this morning, I'm just going to go through these six recollections, one after the other. And then after the tea break, we're going to have a period to reflect on them in a kind of meditation, which I will make up. It's not quite as bad as that. I've probably already made up some of it. So the main thing about this practice, it doesn't have to be done as a sitting meditation. That's just what we're going to do this morning, but it doesn't have to be done that way. The best way to do it is probably in your daily life, is probably to devote a certain period of time to one of them. So for instance, if you were recollecting the Buddha or reflecting on the Buddha, you could decide just to spend an hour doing that. You could decide to spend your whole week or a month or a year where you just focus on recollecting the Buddha, remembering the Buddha and so on, reading books about the Buddha and so on. So what does it mean then to recollect the Buddha, which is the first of these practices? So traditionally this is about bringing to mind the qualities of the Buddha, and these qualities are repeated in a stock form throughout the Buddhist scriptures, throughout these scriptures of the Pali Canon. And they come to us in the form of the Tiratanavandana. If you look in our puja book, you find a Tiratanavandana, which many of us chant before meditation. On retreat, we chant the Tiratanavandana. The Tiratanavandana, of course, is the praise of the three jewels, the praise of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the recollection of the Buddha traditionally is the first verse or couple of verses of the Tiratanavandana. The Tiratanavandana starts with the same line as in the Refuges and Precepts, Nammo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. The very first words, Nammo Tassa, means respectful salutation to him. Yeah? Bhagavato implies someone who stands out from everyone else, someone who has the highest spiritual qualities, someone perhaps awe-inspiring, sublime, auspicious, whatever. And the Buddha is also Arahato, which means worthy or noble. And Samma Sambuddhassa, really and truly awake, really and truly enlightened. So that's the first, the opening, so we chant that usually three times. Then the next verse emphasizes the truth of what has been said. It's itipiso, such indeed is he, such indeed is he. He really is like this. He truly is awake. So the implication is he truly is awake while we're still asleep. We're still dreaming, as it were. We're still compulsively chasing the pleasures as if we were in a dream, or running away from fears as if we were in a dream. While he's free, and we're to some degree imprisoned by delusions, yeah? And then it says he's equipped with knowledge, vicha, and practice, charana. He's equipped with knowledge and practice. In other words, his insight is not merely an intellectual understanding. He's not someone who just speaks well, but he's someone whose life is has attained to real happiness. He's not someone who is still ruled by the same conventional worldly concerns as everyone else. He's attained to real happiness because he's living in reality, not in delusion. Then he is the knower of the worlds, loka vidu. His vision is beyond anything we can conceive, beyond anything we can imagine. And then for all of these reasons, he's referred to as the unsurpassed guide of those to be tamed, Anuttara Purissa Dhamma Sarati. So the Pali word Purissa Dhamma, which here is translated as men to be tamed, according to Sangharakshita, sometimes it means something more like those who wish to be more controlled. It even can mean something like people of the Dharma. So we count ourselves as people who wish to be more controlled. In other words, less given over to greed, hatred, and delusion. So he's the teacher we need to follow. He's unsurpassed, Anuttara, foremost. And in that sense, what we're saying as Buddhists, when we chant that verse, is we're saying that we consider him to be far above any other teacher, and therefore far more important to us than any perhaps fashionable writer or thinker or whatever. So that's the traditional way of recollecting the Buddha. But we don't need to stop there, as it were. We can be creative with the practice. We could, for instance, recollect some of our favourite stories from the Buddha's life. We could recollect stories like the story of Kisagotami, or the story of Magiya, or the story of the Aniruddhas, and so on. We could just reflect on those sort of stories, which already we perhaps have a connection with, or they inspire us. Or we could reflect on the life of the Buddha and the legacy he's left. We could read books, for instance, like that book Gautama by Vishwapani, or The Life of the Buddha by Nyanamoli. Or Karen Armstrong has written quite a good book about the life of the Buddha. So there are lots more, of course. So that is a recollection of the Buddha. That's a reflection on the Buddha, reading The Life of the Buddha. Or we could go even further. We could go towards the Mahayana tradition, later Buddhism. We can reflect on the archetypal Buddhas. We can reflect on Amitabha or Akshobhya or Varochana or Ratnasambhava, so on. The archetypal Buddhas, with all their symbolism, all their colour, gestures, and so on. We can ask ourselves questions. We can ask ourselves how we relate to the Buddha. What image comes to mind, for instance, when we think of the Buddha? Is it an image of someone sitting under a tree becoming enlightened? Is it an image of someone walking the dusty roads of northern India? Is it an image of someone alone in a jungle or something like that? What sort of image comes to mind? Is it someone teaching the Dharma to a group of people? And we can allow, if whatever image comes to our mind, we can allow it to develop in our minds, allow it to become more vivid, more alive for us. Of course, chanting a mantra is another way of recollecting the Buddha. Mantras usually are to do with qualities of the Buddha, qualities of enlightenment. So the Avalokiteshvara mantra is the quality of compassion, the Manjugosha mantra, the quality of wisdom, and so on. So we can reflect on the Buddha in that way. For myself, I do love to read those stories in the Pali Canon about, you know, the Buddha interacting with people. Because in those stories, I catch glimpses of the Buddha as a person, but also his wisdom and his compassion as he goes about his life. So that's something about recollecting the Buddha. Then there's recollecting the Dharma. And again, the traditional way of doing that is the verses of the T. Ratanavandana. So the second part of the T. Ratanavandana starts with this kind of hymn of praise, you could say, to the Dhamma. Dhamma in Pali, Dharma in Sanskrit. And in that, it's a calling to mind of the positive qualities of the teaching. It's calling to mind of our gratitude and respect and reverence for the teaching. So this teaching is described as Bhagavata Dhammo, the Dharma of a Buddha. So it's no ordinary teaching. It's not someone's philosophy or whatever. It's the teaching of a Buddha. It's a teaching of someone who's awakened to the nature of reality. Sangharakshita said, the Dhamma is an expression in words of the ultimate reality of things. The Dhamma, as the Buddha's teaching, is his communication of, his experience of, the ultimate reality of things. It is the Dhamma which has issued from the mind or the spiritual realization of a Buddha, a perfectly enlightened one, and not something which has been fabricated intellectually or put together in an eclectic manner from sources. So this is a teaching that comes from a higher dimension of being, a higher state of consciousness. It's a teaching worthy of reverence, to which we can, as it were, honorably bow our heads. So the Dhamma is said in the verse, it's said to be well communicated, svakato, well communicated. So it's been put into a form which we can understand, using not only our rational minds, as it were, but also it's been put into the form of parables and metaphors and poetic imagery and so on. The teaching is also said to be immediately apparent, sanditiko. It has an observable effect, which we don't need to wait, as it were, for a next life or something like that to experience it. So if we practice the Dhamma, the effects are immediately observable. If we practice the metta bhavana, for instance, we notice the effect on our emotions and on our relationships with others. If we go on retreat, we notice our mental states change. We change in that period. So it's a matter of experience, not speculation. So in reflecting on the Dharma, we could call to mind the ways in which the Dharma has affected us, the way in which it has freed us up or whatever, the way it has affected us. And by reflecting like that, it will stimulate our confidence in the Dharma. It stimulates our faith that it will and can have greater effects in the future. Then it says the Dharma is perennial, akaliko, which means it's timeless, it's free from time, outside of time in a way. So it's, again, it's like a message from a higher dimension of reality, a dimension that's outside of time. Or you could also interpret that as saying it's that the essence of the Dharma is true in any historical period, in any culture, even though it might conflict with the values and the world views that happen to be around at the time, the Dharma is still relevant. And then it says it's of the nature of a personal invitation. We often talk about the Dharma in that way. It's of the nature of a personal invitation. Ehi pasiko, the nature of a personal invitation. So ehi means come, and pasiko means see. So it's the come and see Dharma, come and see. So nobody is forcing us to practice it. We're invited to try it out, to see if it works. And we keep practicing because we know from experience that it does us good, basically. So if we've benefited from the Dharma in the past, then we expect to benefit from it in the future. And the Dharma then is said to be progressive, opanayiko. So opanayiko means leading forward, leading onward. So the Dharma leads us forward, step by step, stage by stage, opening our eyes gradually as our whole inner being develops. So it's a path of organic growth that's progressive and evolutionary. It doesn't ask us to take on anything that we're not yet ready for. So there are always practices that we can do, no matter where we, what stage we're at. There are always practices that are suit our present condition, as it were. And then it says the Dharma is to be understood individually by the wise. Pachatang veditabo vinyuhiti. So pachatang means personally, veditabo means to be known, and vinyuhiti means by those who are wise. Those who understand. So the Dharma is not a dogma that we have to accept on blind faith. We need to explore it, we need to understand it for ourselves and make it our own. So those are the qualities that are brought out in that traditional practice of Dhammanusati, the recollection of the Dharma. We could also, if we're recollecting or reflecting on the Dharma, we could reflect, for instance, what first attracted us to the Dharma? And why? Why did it attract us to the Dharma? And what part does that, whatever it was, what part does it play in our practice now? So we can make this reflection on the Dharma much more personal to us, rather than simply about, as it were, the qualities of the Dharma. We could also bring to mind, of course, rather than just ideas and so on, we can bring to mind symbols of the Dharma and explore those. So, for instance, there's the Dharma Chakra, the wheel of the Dharma. We can explore what that means. I mean, it has a traditional meaning, but we can let our minds go with it. What does it mean? We can explore images like the path. We talk about the path, following the path. What is a path? What does path mean to us? Yeah, we can reflect on that. There's the image of the rain of the Dharma from the White Lotus Sutra. We can reflect on the rain of the Dharma. Or there's the image of the lotus opening. The important thing really is to make a connection with what inspires you and allow yourself to be uplifted. And let yourself experience reverence or gratitude or whatever emerges. Of course, we can also recollect the Dharma as taught to us by Sangharakshita. We might have our own, as it were, favorite teachings from Sangharakshita. Things like mind reactive and creative, or building the Buddha land, or the five stages of spiritual life. Or the teachings about the group, the individual, and the spiritual community, about the higher evolution or the new society. We can always reflect on those teachings as well, or whatever teachings have come to us from Sangharakshita that we've responded to. Sometimes we may not even know that what we've responded to isn't how the Dharma has been set down traditionally in the Pali Canon. We may not have read the Pali Canon. We may be responding to how Sangharakshita has, as it were, translated and elucidated and clarified that for us. So it's important that we recognize that as well. Then comes the third reflection. So the third recollection or reflection is the Sangha. And again, traditionally, this is the third verse of the Tiratanavandana. And that verse opens with a number of phrases in praise of the Sangha, the third jewel, the Sangha. The Sangha is referred to as Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, the spiritual community of those who are disciples, of those who are open to the Buddha and his teaching. Savaka is a disciple. So it's the spiritual community of disciples, the spiritual community of those who are receptive to the Dharma. And then the Sangha is happily proceeding, supatipanno. The members of the Sangha, of the community, proceed well and happily. They're treading a positive path, moving forward on this path of practice and doing that happily. And then it says they're uprightly proceeding. Uju patipanno. So upright. Uju means straight or upright. So obviously that has an ethical implication, that they're upright in the sense of being ethical, being ethically sensitive and so on. It can also mean something like that they're on the straight path, yeah? They're moving along the path in a straight direction, as it were. And the Sangha are also methodically proceeding. Nyaya patipanno, methodically proceeding. They practice systematically according to a definite method, where each stage builds on what went before. Sometimes that's quite difficult for us to do, to practice methodically. We want to go further than we're ready for. We want to jump ahead, or we're greedy for results, as it were, so we're looking far ahead. But actually, we can just trust that if we practice, the results will follow. We just need to practice. We need to do our meditation. We need to be ethical, trust, as it were, in the law of karma. We don't need to jump ahead. We don't need to find new teachings or whatever. And then the final way in which the Sangha is said to be proceeding is Samichi Patipanno. And in the Puja book, this is translated as correctly proceeding. But in a seminar that Bhante did on the Tiratanavanda, he gave another interpretation. He talked about it as harmoniously proceeding, proceeding together, proceeding in harmony. So we don't just practice the Dharma for our own spiritual benefit, our own spiritual progress. We practice to create a harmonious community of individuals. And that's essential for us as individuals. We need other people around us. We need the help of others in order to practice. Even if that's just the help in the sense that other people are sitting meditating while we're meditating, that encourages us and well, helps us with our discipline, as it were. And then it says that this fellowship of the Buddha's disciples is worthy of worship, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, and worthy of salutation. Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakhineyo, anjalikaraniyo. And the reason that these people are worthy at this level of respect is that they are an incomparable source of goodness to the world. That's what it says in the Tiratanavanda. Anutarang punyaketang lokasati, an incomparable source of goodness to the world. So at this point in the recollection, we could call to mind all the great figures of Buddhist tradition, people who have been the great teachers, people like, I suppose, in the Buddha Gosha, for instance, in the Theravadan tradition, but also people later on like Milarepa, like Tsongkhapa and so on, or even people that we're more familiar with in the present day. And we can also call to mind, because we're talking about the Sangha here, we can talk about people that we actually know, people that we have a particular respect for, people that we've maybe learned from. We can call them to mind. And we could connect with our sense of gratitude for the great gift that people have given us. Perhaps we can even imagine ourselves bowing to them respectively. Because people who transmit the Dharma to future generations, such people are indeed an incomparable source of goodness to the world. So we could reflect on the importance of Sangha. We could reflect on the truth of the interconnection or the interdependence between us. And we can reflect on the Sangha as our spiritual community as a practice that we do. One of the things I like to do in this sense is just bring to mind my own experience of large gatherings of the Sangha, large gatherings of the spiritual community. Things that I've experienced, such as festival days, for instance, or such as order conventions, or any event where we come together to practice. To practice, to chat, and just to enjoy each other's company. So just reflecting on those things can also give us a sense of the value, the importance of the spiritual community. So So that's the first three reflections, which some of us will probably be very familiar with because we chant the Tiratanavandana. Then we come to the other reflections. So this next one is a reflection on our own generosity. So this is what the sutta says. It says, there is the case where you recollect your own generosity. Excuse me. It is a gain, a great gain for me, that among people overcome with the stain of possessiveness, I live at home, my awareness cleansed of the stain of possessiveness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in being magnanimous, responsive to requests, delighting in the distribution of alms. At any time when a disciple of the Noble One is recollecting generosity, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight based on generosity. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma, is one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. So you can bring to mind acts of generosity, your own acts of generosity. You can reflect on how to be less possessive, how to be, as the sutta says, cleansed of the stain of possessiveness. You can bring to mind ways in which you are already open-handed, already non-attached, not possessive. You can bring to mind what it feels like to be generous. What does it feel like when you're generous? The feelings of expansiveness, say, or even joy. And of course, you can go deeper into reflecting what it means to be responsive to requests, or delighting in the distribution of alms, as the sutta says. You can reflect on what it means to be generous, why it's important, and how you do it, how you are generous. I mean, often when we think of generosity, we think of things like money or gifts or whatever, but generosity is much broader than that. It's a giving of yourself, really. It's a giving in a sense of making yourself available. So we talk about giving confidence, we talk about giving culture or education, and of course we talk about giving the Dharma. So it's an attitude of openness and expansiveness, rather than being closed or tight or held in, as it were. And you can reflect, of course, on how the practice of generosity can help to loosen any tightness around money or material things. It can help to move us out of a poverty mentality into a sense of abundance, a sense of freedom. There's this sense of freedom, if we practice generosity, that sense of freedom is the beginnings of a more complete sense of non-attachment. And that sense of non-attachment is the precursor to a letting go of any sense of a fixed and separate self. So when we begin to go beyond our attachment to this self, this fixed or separate self, then we're starting to partake of the wisdom of the Buddha. And our sense of abundance and our sense of generosity expands continuously. So that's the fourth recollection, recollecting your own generosity. Then there's the fifth recollection. So if that wasn't hard enough, the fifth one is recollecting your own virtues. So again, this is what the sutta says. There is the case where you recollect your own virtues. And this is how you do it. It says they are unbroken, flawless, unblemished, liberating, praised by the wise, untarnished, conducive to concentration. And it goes on to say that the same as it said about generosity, when you're reflecting on your own virtues, you're not being given over to greed, hatred, and delusion, and it gives you a sense of the goal, and you become joyful, and so on. So the reason for recollecting your own integrity or your own virtues, according to the sutta, is that while you're doing that, your mind is free from these other things like greed or hatred or whatever. So you could do this practice by bringing the positive precepts to mind, the positive precepts and the practices of non-violence and contentment and honesty and mindfulness. You can bring those to mind and reflect on how they manifest in your own life or how you practice them. You can reflect, for instance, on how your ethical life has changed and hopefully improved over time. Yeah, you could bring to mind your own good qualities. So it's, in a way, this could be like the first stage of the metta bhavana, reflecting on your own virtues. For some reason, many people are very wary of rejoicing in their own worth or their own virtues. Some people even find it difficult to accept genuine praise or rejoicings from others. So that could be, there could be all sorts of reasons for that. It could be due to a fear of being thought arrogant, or could be due to low self-esteem, or it might be a fear of the responsibility that comes with strength and awareness. There's a kind of responsibility that comes with having virtues, yeah, to live them out, yeah. Anyway, whatever the reason, it's important to be able to have at least a realistic appraisal of yourself. So not rejecting your weaknesses, but also not rejecting your strengths and your virtues and your qualities. It can really hold us back if we're attached to a view of ourselves as worthless or something like that, or incapable. Yeah? If we think of ourselves as incapable of understanding, or incapable of practicing, or incapable of contributing, then that really holds us back. So it's really important to actually look where we are capable, where we are, where we do have understanding, and so on. And it really helps with this whole process if we, in any groups that we're in, whether they're study groups or team, class teams or whatever, any groups we're in, if we actually rejoice in each other. Because sometimes what other people can see us more clearly and see our qualities and see what we have to offer much more clearly than we see ourselves. So if we can hear that, but really take it on board, perhaps even write it down and refer back to it when the time comes, when the need arises, as it were. It could be when you're trying to recollect your own qualities or whatever, you could think about yourself in the third person, as if you were thinking about another person, as if you were talking about another person, or imagining that a friend was rejoicing in you. So that might be a way of creating a sufficient distance for you to not feel that you're being boastful or something like that, but actually at the same time taking on board your own qualities. So the final recollection is the recollection of the gods. So the gods here symbolize higher states of consciousness. Higher, that is, than greed, hatred, and delusion. So hopefully we've all experienced higher states of consciousness. We've all experienced states of consciousness that are not completely, as it were, stained or tainted with greed, hatred, or delusion. And this recollection is also specifically about faith or confidence in spiritual practice. So the way it's explained in the sutta, as it were, is that to be born as a god, so someone in a higher state of consciousness, you need to have sufficient faith in spiritual practice to do it over a long period of time. So what you're recollecting at this stage, in a way, is you're recollecting your spiritual aspiration. You're recollecting your confidence in spiritual practice. And you're also recollecting the fruits of your practice so far. And recollecting, of course, reflecting on the fruits of your practice increases your confidence. In a way, this practice brings to mind that image of the Buddha, the earth-touching mudra, which we have here on this Buddha, the earth-touching mudra, which is a gesture of confidence. So in the Buddha's story, this was the Buddha, as it were, recollecting his past and recollecting all the practice he had done, and that is the confidence, that's the ground on which is built the further awakening. So recollecting our virtues is a kind of touching the earth. That's what we're doing. We're touching the earth. We're establishing our own confidence in the practice of the Dharma. And you could, in this final recollection, for instance, you could reflect on the occasions when you have experienced greater happiness or greater awareness or greater confidence, perhaps on retreat or something like that. You could reflect on what you really have confidence in. Or even just reflecting on what does it mean to have confidence in something. Okay, so these are the six recollections, the six anusatis that the Buddha recommended to Mahanama. It doesn't say, by the way, whether Mahanama went away and did these practices or not, so we don't know the next thing, and I won't know if you go away and do them either, so this kind of reflection of the sutta. And the Buddha says that to do this practice is beneficial, and I'll tell you again why it's beneficial. I've read this before. Because in whoever does this practice, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight based on the qualities of the devas, it says here, the qualities of the gods, in other words, those higher states of consciousness. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the noble ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of Dharma, gains joy connected with the Dharma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. In other words, you could say what this practice gives you is a sense of what your life is about. And having a sense of what your life is really about is calming and conduces to happiness. So this is a, as I said earlier, this is a mindfulness practice rather than a meditation practice. That means you don't have to sit in meditation posture, etc., to do this practice. This is a practice to be taken into everyday life, into the activities of everyday life. As the sutta says, you should develop this recollection while you're walking, while you're standing, while you're sitting, while you're lying down, while you're busy at work, while you're resting at home, resting in your home crowded with children. So it's a practice to counteract our tendency to get caught up in narrow, unhelpful, even unskillful mental states. And in that respect, it's somewhat like mindfulness of the body or mindfulness of our surroundings. Any mindfulness practice really counteracts our tendency to get caught up in narrow, unhelpful, or unskillful mental states. So it's a method of filling our minds with positive, uplifting reflections. And after the tea break, which we're going to have in a few minutes, we'll do this practice as a meditation. So I will lead you through. I'll drop little hints, probably similar things to what I've said in the talk, as to what you can reflect on. And we'll just go through the six stages for half an hour or 40 minutes or so. And then in this afternoon, we're going to have a ritual, which Arya Jaya is going to tell us about in a minute, where you can make an offering which symbolizes one or more of these reflections. And as I said earlier, this practice doesn't need to be done in any particular way. So you could stick with one of these reflections or recollections for days and days on end, or for a long time. You need to, with this kind of mindfulness practice, you need to work out what works for you and what's appropriate for you at a particular time. But anyway, whichever way you do it, what you might find is that whatever you reflect on, whether it's the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, your own virtues or whatever, it will quite naturally lead you on to the other recollections, because they are all connected. They're all connected. In some ways, they're just one recollection, one reflection. Anyway, that's all I want to say now. I'm going to hand you over now to Arya Jaya, who's going to just say a little bit about what's happening after lunch. Yeah?